You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Historian Lucy Worsley is my guest this week. You've seen her on the History Channel and on PBS in America, and she's on BBC like all the time. And she's the author of many books, including several for us young readers. Her new book is a fascinating, in-depth biography of the most successful novelist in history. The book is called Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman. Lucy Worsley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really enjoyed your book, and I think one of the things I loved about it is that you are the person telling us the story of Agatha Christie. It's not just a voice, it's clearly you who's telling the story. And I wonder if having been on TV a lot makes you comfortable in relating your story this way.
That's an interesting question. I feel that probably the fact that I do other things than write books is relevant. I also in my life work on exhibitions and have done TV and radio. So I'm very, very conscious of the fact that history is written in the present moment. And as a historian, I like to see myself as the thin end of the wedge of history. I'll use whatever tricks I can to make it seem relevant to people's lives and to get them over the threshold and into the world of the past. And I must admit, when I was writing, I was speaking to a 15-year-old girl. I don't know her, but someone sitting in her bedroom in Nottingham, as I once was, reading books and using them as a way of learning about the world. History helps us understand the world today, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the important part of it, right?
I think so. A lot of historians would say, I try to set my prejudices aside. I see where they're coming from, but I like to get my prejudices out in the sunlight, if you like, and say what they are. That feels like an honest approach to me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that your book is necessarily a critical approach, but at the same time, you let us know, oh, this is one of my favorite books, or this was not such a good book, and that kind of thing.
Yes, that's true. And I'm also very interested in the way that Agatha Christie's life and experience, extraordinary though it was, it also touched upon the concerns of ordinary women, things like being a working mum and going through divorce and experiencing a lot of the big social upheavals of the 20th century, like the two world wars. So I wanted to treat her as extraordinary, but in some ways ordinary and very, very slightly relatable too.
Well, there have been a few other Agatha Christie biographies. And so I wonder, why did you want to write one? What is wrong with the other ones?
There's nothing wrong with the other ones. Such admirable writers. The two best ones are Janet Morgan's from the 1980s and Laura Thompson's from the beginning of this century. And they're both fabulous. What I felt that maybe it was time to do was to take more of a historian's look at it. Janet Morgan's goes very scrupulously through the archive and sort of dots all the I's and crosses all the T's. Laura Thompson's is a reader's biography, if I can put it that way. It really celebrates the novels. And as a historian, what really caught my eye was the way that Christie herself was kind of the living embodiment of the 20th century. It's people don't necessarily remember this about her because she seems like an institution. Certainly, if you're British, she feels like the wallpaper of our minds. She's just always there in the background somehow. But she was born in 1890 under Queen Victoria and lived till 1976, which crosses into my own lifetime when, you know, the Rolling Stones were around. What enormous changes she witnessed.
You know, I remember well when, because I'm so much older than you, Lucy Worsley, but I remember well when, like, Curtin was a Book of the Month Club selection and it was a big deal. And she was at the end of her life, she was a major, kind of star author.
Yes, although she never presented herself in that way, which is one of the things that I find intriguing and elusive about her. But she seems sort of out of place amongst the other stars of the 60s and the 70s, yet she was right up there in the firmament.
Well, I think one of the themes of your book, Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman, is that she's misunderstood, that her writing is misunderstood, and that the person she was is very misunderstood.
Well, she really didn't help with this herself. It sounds perhaps impertinent to say it, but later on in her life, she had this whole shtick going on that she was just ordinary, just a housewife. She says that when she filled in forms, she wouldn't put down author or writer or megastar. She'd just put down housewife, as if her success had happened sort of by accident. But that's really doing herself down. And if you sort of look through the veil, I think that she expressed herself in this very reticent way because of the values of her Edwardian upbringing, where young ladies weren't really supposed to work. And then I think there was a real change in this pivot point in her life, the notorious year of 1926, which I'm sure we'll come on to, this famous year. And before that, she would speak quite openly about ambition and her career and being a working writer. After that point, a lot of those things sort of dropped away from the few and very guarded public interviews and statements that she'd make about her life and her work.
Now, do you think sexism affected her appraisal, not only others' appraisal of her work and who she was, but of her own appraisal of her work?
Yeah, I guess you could say it was a kind of internalized sexism, perhaps. I feel that in lots of ways, she is a role model for working female writers, and yet she would never have spoken of herself in that way. But if you look at her actions rather than her words, and, you know, sometimes the words of her female characters, Miss Marple has some interesting things to say about the capabilities of women, then you get a different view. And what's always said about Agatha Christie is that she is the best-selling writer ever after the Bible and Shakespeare. And what blows my mind about that statement is that people don't generally follow it up with, and unlike Shakespeare and, well, I guess God, she was a woman doing this in a world made by men. That makes her achievement all the more extraordinary. And I think she made it seem less weird and perhaps safer by downplaying her own role in her achievement.
And also your book mentions, and it's kind of a surprising find, that she is the most successful dramatist in the world in some ways.
That's true. She's the most performed female playwright in history. And you can really, you can see that she could have been so many other things when she started to write. She was dipping her toe into all sorts of different genres, not just detective fiction. That was the one that sold best, so that was the one that she pursued. And you can see that she gets a real sense of energy from writing plays. She had been writing them ever since she was little. She was from a family who were very interested in drama and thespian activities. She used to herself perform in family pantomimes, wearing her sister's tights, pretending to be the pantomime boy and strutting around. But success as a playwright came to her quite late, after the age 40. And then partly because of the kind of way that she becomes a useful person to show how highbrow you are. In the 20th century, if you're a critic, you say, oh, I must be really a great, clever person because I don't think that Agatha Christie is any good. The critical reception of her plays has definitely dropped away as time has passed, but they were all over the West End. And extraordinarily, The Mousetrap will be running tonight, just up the road from me in Soho. And Witness for the Prosecution will be running tonight as well, just along the bank of the river.
Wow. Uh-huh. And The Mousetrap still has the original cast. That's the incredible part, right?
It doesn't have the original cast. How old do they have to be? Oh, but do you know the I believe that the voice that comes out of the gramophone is the original recording.
Oh, well, that's cool.
And the clock on the mantelpiece is the original clock. They're very proud of that. And they still have a really old wind machine that belonged to the play's original producer, Peter Saunders. And it's got this big handle on it, and you turn it round and round and round. And I had a go with it the other day. It produces the sound of the storm, which, if you know the plot of The Mousetrap, is an important feature.
Oh, that's fun. I think Witness for the Prosecution is by far the best movie ever made of an Agatha Christie story. I love the film. It's a wonderful film.
It is. It is. Now, there's always this problem with films of Christie, which is that many of them really upset the author herself. She felt that the cinema didn't often capture her vision, but that was definitely a goodie. And she wasn't alive to see all the very famous TV adaptations with David Suchet and his rather lovely, gormless Hastings, Hugh Fraser, which is what I used to watch with my granny on Sunday nights.
Yeah.
And I think they've sort of done her a disservice by making people think that all of her stories were set in a world of circa 1932, and that it was a world of, you know, period drama, vintage motor cars, croquet, flapper dresses, and that there was something a bit heritagey, something a bit cozy about that. And people have lost sight of the fact that because she was writing from 1920 until 1976, and because she was writing in the present day, she was all about modernity. She was about what people thought about the world in that particular year in which she was writing. And that's a view that unfolded and changed and developed as the 20th century wore on.
Yeah, you mentioned, I haven't read every single Agatha Christie novel, I must admit, but you mentioned that some of them have psychedelic drugs and all kinds of, you know, modern things in them.
Well, Miss Marple says in one of the books, the essence of life is going forward. And in a later book at Bertram's Hotel, for example, she quotes the phrase, the winds of change twice, the wind of change twice. And she's actually sort of subliminally quoting Harold Macmillan on the ending of the British Empire. These large universal themes are there, even in what on the face of it is a detective story.
I was thinking when you were talking earlier about how Miss Marple would say certain things that maybe are the thoughts of Agatha Christie, that it's almost like a ventriloquist. You know, a ventriloquist allows their dummies to say all the rude things that they wouldn't say.
Yes, yes. I personally really believe that Agatha Christie's most treasured character is Miss Marple. And after World War II, you see them growing older together at the same pace. And as time goes on, Miss Marple adopts some of the characteristics of later life Christie herself, like getting, Miss Marple becomes rich and she goes to the Caribbean, things that Christie was able to do at the height of her success. And they also have some of the same strategies for misdirecting our attention away from their big brains. Like an interest in gardening. You know, Miss Marple is interested in gardening, but it's also an excuse for her to hang about in the village and see who's coming and who's going.
Well, yeah, that's a good, and I know, I'm sure Agatha Christie probably invented it, but that's sort of a detective tool to appear to be less than you are. That's like Columbo's thing. I don't know if you know Columbo over there, but that, you disguise your cleverness by pretending to be less than you are.
Sure, sure. But here's the novel thing that Agatha Christie did. Sherlock Holmes, he didn't do that. He was obviously brilliant, right? It was always, oh, let's go to the house of the wonderful Mr. Sherlock Holmes. And he'd say, oh, yes, I'm awfully clever and busy. Well, you know, he was very, well, I'm not saying that Poirot is not full of himself, but the people around Poirot think, ooh, who's this funny little guy? He has a foreign accent. He's got strange facial hair. He's not been to public school. And I sort of see Poirot as stereotypically female. That's, he taps into a lot of the ways in which stereotypical females have to operate because they're not Sherlock Holmes. They're not respectable establishment men.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we are talking this week with Lucy Worsley. She's a historian. She presents histories on PBS, the History Channel, and the BBC. She's written several books, and her new one is Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman.
Lucy Worsley, several times in your book, Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman, you mentioned a particular book as being one, it's on your list of favorites, so this is my one of my top three or something. And Agatha Christie has a lot of titles, I think, what, 80-some titles. Can you give us, like, your top five as a place to start, that readers might start, and assume already that everyone knows Murder on the Orient Express and Death on the Nile because they've been filmed and then filmed again?
Sure. I would start with The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, number one, really, published in 1920. This one's fascinating because it grows out of a vital time in Agatha Christie's life, to my mind. The time that she spent serving as a nurse in the wartime hospital that was set up in the town hall of her hometown, Torquay, on the south coast of England. So she wasn't in Flanders, but during battles, during surges, the wounded would be sent in boats and they would come to be treated in these south coast hospitals, where she did extraordinary things for a nice young Edwardian lady, as she was at that point in her life. She witnessed the bodies of young men wounded and naked and dirty and powerless. And then she had to go home to her mama and not let on. That's what war did. It trained a generation to disguise their feelings, to wear a mask. And Christie stories are all about people who wear masks. And
well, was she trained as a nurse? Did she have any?
She didn't really have any training at all. She was in the voluntary aid detachment, so she had a little bit of light voluntary training. And after a time in the hospital, she moved to the hospital dispensary, where she did get a qualification to assist the pharmacists in mixing the medicines. And this is key because it means handling poisons. It means mixing up medicines where a tiny slip can take it from life-saving to life-destroying. So in The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, you will encounter a young lady dispenser, as Agatha was, who works in a hospital, and there will be a poisoning. And when this book came out, The Pharmaceutical Journal gave it a very good review. They said, here's an author who knows her poisons. Well done.
All right, good. Mysterious Affair at Stiles. The first one, really?
The first one. Yes, yes. The big beginning. And it's, you know, it's not classic Christie in that it's a little bit densely written. There's a lot of clues, but it's so good. And it's the first appearance of Hastings and Poirot, and a lot of the themes that will be addressed in her work come out. The house where it all happens, Stiles, is a matriarchy. It's sort of ruled over by a powerful old lady. And that speaks as well to Agatha's domestic situation in which she grew up. Her father had died when she was 11. And the family fortune had been lost. And in this slightly decaying, large, substantial house in Torquay, she lived with her widowed mother. And her widowed mother had always been a woman of strong will and strong ideas and a strong sense of intuition. And I think that Agatha put her mother into this story as well, in quite a dark way. I mean, is it a spoiler? I hope it's not too much of a spoiler to say that this matriarch in the story is the one who gets bumped off. So she was able to imagine a world in which somebody very like her mother was killed. There's this darkness to Agatha Christie that's very disturbing but attractive at the same time.
Yeah, interesting that you would write a story in which the character that represents your mother is murdered. That reveals a lot about somebody's feelings about their mother, doesn't it?
Well, she used to have this very significant, I think, childhood nightmare, a fantasy, a fearful psychological upset that came back again and again and again. And I think that this is along with the wartime hospital, vital in shaping her. It was a nightmare that she called the gunman. And in her dream, she'd be with her mother. It'd be a normal day. They'd be playing. They'd be having tea. But she'd look up into her mother's face and her mother would suddenly have turned into a stranger, somebody, a man he was, a man with blue eyes. And instead of a hand, he had a stump, a horrible stump. And this idea that somebody you know, somebody respectable, somebody you trust, somebody close to you can suddenly flip like that is central to her fiction too, because in an Agatha Christie story, the murderer is always one of us. It's somebody in the circle. If this moment were an Agatha Christie novel, Gary, the murderer would be either you or me.
In Kenneth Branagh's most recent Agatha Christie film, The Death on the Nile, where he plays Poirot, he has a sort of an origin story of Poirot. And I wonder if that is drawn from the literature. Is there, in Mysterious Affair at Stiles, do we get an origin story of Poirot, or he just comes into the story fully formed?
He doesn't have a massive backstory, and neither does Miss Marple. And there's this sense of privacy about her characters that seems very Christian. But there are hints later on that Poirot has once shot a man during his time in the Belgian police force. And it's the origin story that's presented in the film is really a story about the moustache. So if you've seen the film, you'll know that he's horribly... He's scarred by a First World War wound, and he's with his Catherine, Mon Catherine, who he's having some kind of a relationship with. We don't really know anything about her. And he says, look, I'm obviously going to be too ugly for you now. And she says, never mind, you will grow a moustache. So that's how the screenwriters have chosen to explain the moustache. But then there has been this whole wonderful conspiracy theory. Hang on, you cannot grow a moustache on scar tissue. That doesn't work. So is potentially the moustache itself a false moustache to cover up the scar? The meaning of the moustache is something that's been speculated upon. I asked Agatha Christie's own grandson, who has helped me enormously with my work, and he wasn't letting on. I think he wanted to keep that as a secret of the trade.
Fantastic. All right, what is book number two?
I'm going to pick The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. I love The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. It often gets voted the best detective story ever written. And it's utterly scintillating and perfect. And it contains this very audacious trick that you will hear described as breaking the rules of the detective story, and therefore earned its author this reputation for sort of trickery and duplicity, which came back to bite her. I won't say what the trick is, but I will say that when it comes to spoilers and Agatha Christie, I feel more relaxed about giving spoilers than some people would. And the reason I feel that way is because we've established that Christie's work have an unfairly low critical reputation, right? People don't think of this as literature. Part of that has stemmed from a fear of giving spoilers that basically stops you from discussing the plot of a book, and it basically stops you from doing literary criticism on it, right?
Because it's impossible to discuss that particular book without giving away the ending in the same way that it would be with Endless Night, right?
Yeah, exactly. So some people will know what we're talking about here, other people won't. But I tell you, even if you know the trick, I could reread it with utter pleasure. And it doesn't matter, because the storytelling is so good that each time I'm swept up in the story all over again. And interestingly, I'm verging on a spoiler here. Interestingly, there's a bad doctor in this book, and the bad doctor, again, to me, goes back to Christie's time in the hospital, because one of the ways in which World War One really shook things up is that women like Christie were going into the workplace and they were being told what to do for the first time. And they were being treated quite rudely by the male doctors in the hospital, who in normal times would have been Christie's dance partners as a debutante, as a well-off young lady. And yet the doctors would hand her the towel, which she describes herself as feeling like a human towel rail. It was her job to hand the towel to the doctor, and then the doctor would throw it on the floor and just treat her with disrespect. So you can see World War One as the beginning of the end of a deferential society. And Christie herself was caught up in that. And what her books do is point out the inadequacies, the dark secrets, the rotten nature of so many of the people who are supposed to be in charge. And in her stories to come, doctors will be the most homicidal profession. The job done by the largest number of her murderers is medicine.
Even though they took the vow to never to do no harm.
Yeah, even the people who are supposed to be better than the rest of us have feet of clay.
All right. Mysterious Affair at Styles.
Where are we going next? I go to choose the Murder at the Vicarage.
Murder at the Vicarage.
Yeah, yes, I love the Murder at the Vicarage, which is Miss Marple's first appearance in a full-length novel. She'd been in short stories before. And, I can't tell you how much I love it. It's fantastic. I love the Murder at the Vicarage. And one of the things that's brilliant about it is that the people who were first reading it in 1930, the very first readers, wouldn't even have known that Miss Marple was the detective. I mean, we know now because, you know, it's Miss Marple. Of course, she's going to solve the crime. But then it wasn't even clear that this negligible, slightly ignorable old lady was, you know, going to do
the deed. As she's introduced in the book, you don't know it's her story.
And the cover of the first edition doesn't have a picture of Miss Marple on it as part of this whole, you know, ploy to direct our attention away from the little old lady.
Another ventriloquist. I keep thinking of that. She's a magician, a ventriloquist.
Yes.
Misdirection, yeah.
Yes. And what's interesting about early Miss Marple is that she's less saccharine than late Miss Marple. She gets kind of nicer as the decades go on. But in Murder at the Vicarage, the vicar and his brilliantly funny wife. People don't realise how funny Christie is if they've only seen the TV adaptations rather than read the actual dialogue on the page. You see, that's another spoiler thing. If you prioritise the plot, then you're not able you're not paying attention to the dialogue and the characterisation and the atmosphere that's also brilliantly done. Anyway, this very funny vicar's wife and thinks of Miss Marple and the other old ladies as nasty. Miss Marple actually gets described as a nasty old cat. And I quite like Miss Marple as a nasty old cat, probably because I'm a nasty old cat myself. But it's brilliant to see slightly prickly, difficult women saving the world, becoming superheroes, saving the day, doing good.
Yeah, an unusual, certainly, lead character to be an older, she's 65 or so. Right.
Well, her age is a bit hard to follow. She's older than that when she first appears. She gets younger and then she grows older again. And this is one thing that, you know, Christie does in her work. Her messages are good will triumph over evil. And people do think of her as a conservative writer, but she also has this slightly weirdly progressive edge to her that the outsider is able to do amazing things. I mean, neither Poirot or Marple are married. They don't have families. They don't really fit into society conventionally. And I'm sure that this is one of the reasons that Christie, it seems to me, really appeals to people who feel themselves to be a little bit of an outsider. I mean, everybody likes Poirot, but if you are an outsider in any way yourself, perhaps you really love him. He's the nerd's nerd, if you like. He's one for the kids who are never cool.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're chatting this week with historian Lucy Worsley. She's written many books and presented histories on television. Her new book is called Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman. And right before the break, Lucy Worsley was giving us her top five Agatha Christie novels, and right now we're at number four, Lucy Worsley.
Shall we choose Taken at the Flood? because this one's quite a good one for illustrating how Christie changes with the times. This one is set just after World War II. And, oh, I should have said about Murder at the Vicarage. That was written in 1930. And I think its brilliance is the fruit of her happiness, because by that point, her first marriage had failed. And she had got together with her beloved second husband, who she stayed married to for 44 years. And she wrote it to him as a kind of a wedding present. Came out the year they married. And in it, there's a joke. He was an archaeologist. And the archaeologist in the book turns out to be a thief. I feel that was a jokey wedding present to him. And the two of them were separated for the few years of World War II. He served in North Africa with the RAF, while she rolled up her sleeves. She's such a practical person, really got on with things, and went to work at a hospital dispensary once again in Blitztime London. And then when he returned home, she wrote this novel that brilliantly captures the sense of upheaval and dislocation that a lot of people were feeling after World War II. Her readers were, she spoke brilliantly to a lot of people, but she really tapped into the anxieties of what you might call Middle England, people who read the Daily Mail, people who could see that after World War II, things were not going to go back to normal, people who perhaps had inherited wealth, fixed incomes related to the stock market and that sort of thing that were ebbing away, people who'd used to be able to afford servants and who couldn't anymore, and people who were worried about new people coming into the village, wartime upheaval, are people deserters? Who are these people? Do they have letters of introduction? And that's a theme of Taken at the Flood, which kicks off with a bombing raid. A house is destroyed in the Blitz, and that in real life, once you know about Christie's life, you just see it coming up again and again in her novels. And that in real life seems to be the house that she and Max shared in London that was destroyed by bombs.
Wow. All right, one more.
That would be very hard to pick. You're putting me on the spot here. What on earth am I going to choose? I'm going to choose Nemesis, which is fabulous. This is late period Miss Marple, when she has become ever so fluttery, always snuggled up in her lacy pink woolen knitted shawl, appearing to be very frail, ready to blow away in a gust of wind. And yet she has also become by this point deadly, indomitable. There's something primeval about her. In this book, there are three sisters who sound like sort of figures from ancient Greek myth. And then Nemesis herself, this mythical figure, that is Miss Marple bringing justice. And as Agatha herself aged, I guess her views began to seem like they were shifting over to the right. She really, really, really did try to stay up to date. And as you said, talked about miniskirts and psychedelic drugs and that sort of thing in the 60s. But she and her readers were becoming older. And there's a sense that they were, you know, made uncomfortable by things like the getting rid of the death penalty. They had a very black and white view of the world. And by the time we get to Nemesis, the Home Secretary in the story, the Home Secretary, so the absolute establishment, says that Miss Marple is the most frightening woman he's ever met. And that might be something that you would think if you met Agatha Christie in later life, who had become formidable. She had become the empress of this vast empire. She had loads of people working for her. People were very anxious about her opinion about things. And she had become reclusive. There's a very funny letter. Her letters to her agent are hilarious. And they say things like, Edmund, get me out of this. You know all the right things to say. And Edmund, is there somebody in your office who can forge my signature? And she becomes a pretty frightening woman as well.
And do you think her, you talk a lot about in your, in, Agatha Christie and Elusive Woman, Lucy Worsley. You talk a lot about the tax problems that she had, and could that have led her to a more right-wing kind of philosophy?
Well, she definitely had conflicting ideas about money throughout her life. So she's so elusive in so many ways. What she actually thinks about money is elusive too. I think this early on in her career, she was just delighted to earn money. We know that she blew one particular advance she got for serialization on a fast car. Yes, 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 I can have a car. Didn't set aside any of that for paying tax, right? The Millers, her parents, had given her absolutely minimal education. She hardly went to school. She went for a couple of days a week for a few years. And certainly they didn't teach her any sort of life lessons about planning your finances. So she never took that seriously. She liked earning and she liked spending, but the concept of wealth never meant anything to her. And certainly after 1926, when she became very reluctant to confront the fact that she was a professional writer and part of an industry with certain obligations, she became reluctant to pay her taxes too. The tax office, it's fair to say, didn't help. There's one very funny letter that says, come on, we need to sort out this mess that she's got herself into with the back taxes. But we understand that Agatha Christie is, in fact, a pen name. And what we want is the tax district of the husband. They couldn't believe that she had, you know, actually writing the books herself. So she got into this huge mess financially. And that's partly why she went on writing into later life. That's sometimes what she'd say when she was a bit bored of producing the book. And yet, I think that she couldn't help it. I think she was just, her writing was her way of making sense of the world and of herself. And I spoke to, I interviewed one of her editors, who I'm happy to say is still alive and well. And sometimes he would go and stay with her in her fabulous house. It's called Greenway. It's a mansion by the river in Devon that she bought and which she lived in later life. And when she was there, she would very much perform this role as the lady of the manor. She'd have people to stay. There'd be sumptuous food and you'd never see her actually doing any writing or work. No, no, no. She was just a housewife, remember. But Philip Ziegler, who knew her well as her editor, he said to me, well, even though that's what she wanted her guests to think, there was nothing going to stop her from indulging in a little bit of work. So she would just slip off and get on with it, lose herself in the world of words.
Today, we're very, audiences are very enlightened. And when we watch old films, we can't help but see all the sexism and racial insensitivity and outright racism in some earlier works. And I know that you personally have had issues with this kind of political correctness or whatever you want to call it. And so when readers encounter certain things in Agatha Christie, how much of that is simply that Agatha Christie was a person of her time, and how much reflects actual racial insensitivity or antisemitism?
Well, when people bring this up, I think they often expect one of two answers. One answer, which is she was a person of her class and time. What else did you expect? Or yeah, they expect that is really regrettable. We don't want to go there. We don't want to read Christie. And I think the answer is neither of those things. I mean, it's not good enough to say, yes, she was a person of her class and time. It's unfortunate that somebody as widely traveled and as well educated as she made herself was prey to some of those attitudes. But I think people get into trouble when they go to these books purely as entertainment and then find that there are some things about that worldview that makes them uncomfortable. But I think that as a historian, we have to go and look at the world as it was. And the books for me are evidence of social history. They're evidence of the way that the world was. And we need to know about that so we can see the legacy that it's had in the world today. We need to not go, oh, tut tut and move on. We need to confront it. People need to know about this, particularly, well, I'm generalizing here and perhaps being ageist, but I think that young people who don't know about Agatha Christie will be missing out if they don't go and look at this hugely significant cultural figure. And certainly if you've got any kind of aspirations to be a writer or a detective writer, you need to know what she did, because she did it better than anybody else. You need to be able to build on her.
I want to ask you also about her work as an archaeologist and her husband's work. Like recently, the Metropolitan Museum of Art had to return all kinds of antiquities. There's this period that you talk about in your book in which archaeology is like treasure hunting, like find this thing and keep it, right?
Agatha originally traveled to West Asia as a kind of a fresh start in life after her divorce. She traveled alone, quite adventurous for a single English woman to do that at the time. And she got into all sorts of scrapes along the way, because people are so anxious to befriend a lone female traveler. Once she got invited to a night of pleasure by an Italian, and she put him off by saying that as an English woman, she was naturally frigid and he should give up and leave alone. Anyway, she traveled to see the ancient city of Ur that was being excavated then. And there she met a young archaeological assistant, fresh from Oxford, whose name was Max Malamud, and he would become her second husband. And so that is why she became so drawn into the world of archaeology. And she, I argue in my book, became a significant funder of his digs, although that was never made public, again, because it was kind of unacceptable for a man to have his wife pay for his career. And what's really interesting about the way his career unfolds is that you can see this changing history of archaeology. You can see that disputes about where the finds should go were starting to happen in the 1930s. I mean, we think of this as a modern phenomenon, but he had to stop digging in Iraq, actually, because the Iraqi National Museum said that they wanted to keep finds in the country. And as the 20th century unrolls, you see archaeology becoming less something that's done by Westerners to West Asians, and more something that West Asians are totally in control of, as is the way today. I'm very intrigued by that sort of story, the story of archaeology. And I feel that there's something that needs putting right here, because when Agatha Christie and archaeology come up, people think, oh, that was a quaint hobby. That's interesting. It was, in fact, part of the soft power of the British Empire in a part of the world where oil was really important. That was kind of the meaning of archaeological activity. And when Agatha's own activities on the dig are described, she's really famous for having cleaned and put back together a set of fragmentary ivories, beautiful carved ivories that were discovered in a well at the site of Nimrud in Iraq, where Max Mallow and her husband did his most important work. And she cleaned these ivories using a knitting needle and some face cream, cold cream for the face. She used it to coax the dirt out of the crevices. And this is what comes up, this very feminine image of the gentle, delicate cleaning of the ivories. And it has been described as Agatha Christie's most significant contribution to archaeology. Not true. Her most significant contribution to archaeology was to write the book. She spent part of each morning on the dig writing the book that would help to pay for the next year's dig. I mean, she was a big funder of archaeology.
All right. So we haven't talked about 1926 and her famous disappearance, and there's so much else that we haven't talked about Lucy Worsley, and we're out of time. It's a really marvelous book, Agatha Christie, An Elusive Woman. And I'm so grateful that you made time for From the Bookshelf. Thank you so much, Lucy Worsley, for being with us.
My total pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.